Dr. Robin Clark is an associate professor of family medicine, community health, and quantitative health sciences at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He is also director of research and evaluation at the School Center for Health Policy and Research. And Dr. Clark's presentation will be on does prior authorization of buprenorphine save money or reduce diversion? So welcome Dr. Clark, please.
So I'll be talking about a somewhat overlapping population here. I want to acknowledge the members of my research team here, and we have no conflicts to disclose at this point. So I'm going to be talking about buprenorphine naloxone, which is now, I think, the most prescribed medication for treatment of opioid addiction in the country. It was introduced in 2003 as a treatment for opioid addiction. It had been around before as a pain medication. It combines both an opioid agonist and an opioid antagonist, and is considered to be significantly more safer than methadone, which is the primary medication-assisted treatment for opioid addiction. And it's the first one that can be dispensed in an outpatient setting and taken without direct observation, which makes it much more appealing to patients. The recommended dose now is around 16 milligrams, and doses over 24 milligrams are not recommended. We're particularly interested in Medicaid populations, one, because they have a higher rate of substance abuse diagnoses than any other insured group. And Medicaid programs around the country, just to remind you, Medicaid is a program that is jointly funded by the state and federal government, but is operated by the states. So Medicaid programs are the leading payers for medication-assisted treatment for opioid addiction. There's increasing concern around the country about both the cost of buprenorphine and diversion of buprenorphine. There's some evidence that suggests that lower dose levels may reduce diversion. On the flip side, people who get higher doses sometimes are known to sell that. And I think 47 states now have a prior authorization requirement for buprenorphine, and some have been making those prior authorization requirements more and more stringent over time. So just to look at the Massachusetts Medicaid program, which is called MassHealth, you can see the blue part of the bar there is other kinds of treatment. So that includes drug-free treatment as well as methadone. And then the tan part is buprenorphine. Starting in 2003, when it was introduced, I think about midway through the year, through 2010, where you can see that there are about 18,000 people who are currently using the medication. So significant increase. And if you look at the expansion in substance abuse treatment over this period of time, it's almost all attributable to buprenorphine. So I probably don't need to tell this group much about prior authorization, but prescribers have to get authorization before a prescription is filled. And primarily, this is used as a means to reduce the cost of medication and sometimes to improve safety, typically imposed by an insurer, but it's particularly favored by Medicaid programs because they can't use the financial incentives like tiered pricing that private insurers can use. Sometimes there are unanticipated effects. It doesn't always reduce costs. In fact, sometimes prescribers can substitute more expensive drugs for the one that is restricted. It may cause a break in treatment continuity, which can lead to, in this case, relapse or higher hospitalization rates. And there are lots of examples of that sort of thing happening. So we were particularly interested and the kind of prior authorization requirement that the Massachusetts Medicaid program chose to implement, which I believe is different from any other approach in the country. It's a dose-based prior authorization requirement, and you can see that the higher the dose, the more frequent the authorization is required. So if you have above 32 milligrams, each prescription requires an authorization. 24 to 32 every 90 days, all the way down to if you're at 16 milligrams or below the recommended dosage, there's no prior authorization required. So we're particularly focused on the question of, first, does this have any impact on high-dose treatment? Does it affect medication costs or total costs? And total health care costs includes everything else that Medicaid is paying for the patients. And did it affect relapse rates? Here, we constructed a measure of relapse using Medicaid claims, and we defined a relapse as use of detoxification, an emergency room visit for a primary diagnosis of substance use disorder, or hospitalization for the same reason. So we used Medicaid claims beginning the year before the prior authorization requirement was implemented through the year after it was implemented. We supplemented that with some data from other public programs that helped us capture additional relapses that may have been paid outside of the Medicaid program. We focused only on people who use this buprenorphine-naloxone combination. There is a pure buprenorphine version that's sometimes used primarily for women who are pregnant. And sort of for ease in understanding this, we divided the groups into three separate groups: a low dose, a medium dose, and a high dose group. And we conducted two kinds of analyses. One was a population level analysis where we looked at each month everyone in the MassHealth program who is being treated with buprenorphine naloxone for opioid addiction. So they had to also have a diagnosis of opioid addiction. So this is these are both time series analyses. The second, we identified a group that was using buprenorphine naloxone in 2007 and followed that group. They had to also continue using it into 2008. So we followed that group over the two-year period. And we used generalized estimating equations for both. So this is just a kind of a table one comparison of that last group, the group that was using in 2007, just to show you that there are, in fact, some differences in these groups, these dose groups. The high-dose group tended to be a little older. It had more men. And interestingly, the low-dose group was significantly more expensive than the medium or high-dose groups here. These other differences in mental and physical conditions are not statistically significant.
The total disparity of care excludes the cost of the combination.
You mean excludes the cost of the medication?
Yes.
No, it doesn't. It includes it. That's everything. So here is the population level analysis before and after implementation of the prior authorization requirement, just to orient you to this. The blue line at top is the low dose group. The red line is the medium dose group. And the green line is the high dose group. So we've got two vertical lines here. The solid line is the date that the requirement became law. And then if you look at the authorization periods, you'll see that it could take as long as 6 months for this to roll out. So that is our dotted line there. These differences were all significant. You can see some increase of about 8%, 7 or 8% for the low-dose group, an increase of about 10% of the medium-dose group, and the high-dose group went down from about 18% to about 4%, 3 or 4%. Looking at the costs, obviously the buprenorphine expenditures went down significantly in the high-dose group, increased in other groups. The net savings for the entire population range from about $130,000 to just under $500,000, which is really pretty small in the context of a program that costs $10.5 billion a year. So not very much in the way of savings, and no difference in overall health care costs. One thing we did see when we looked at relapses, and again, this is a little confusing here, but same color scheme. The blue lines are low dose, the red lines are medium dose, and the green lines are high dose. Typically, you can see the medium and the low dose groups prior to implementation are running at higher relapse rates. There's a brief period right after full implementation where the medium and low-dose groups actually increase and they're larger, have larger relapse rates than the low-dose group. But this only lasts for a very short period of time. And if you look at the entire period, it's actually returned to an even lower level. So we see this as a temporary impact here. Limitations, these are administrative data with all the problems of possible underdiagnosis and misdiagnosis. We don't have a comparison group here because this was implemented for the entire population. So that means that we can't completely rule out some of those secular effects. We did, in the generalized estimating equation, in the cohort analysis, control for all of those differences you saw in table one there, plus some additional variables. So in summary, we conclude that the PA does seem to have effectively lowered high doses. There's a modest decrease in buprenorphine costs, but not enough to really make that the only motivation, I think, for undertaking a policy like this. Had no impact on total costs. There was a temporary increase in relapses, but that seemed to return to normal very quickly. And we certainly need to know more about the impact of dose limits on diversion. We can only get at that indirectly by looking at the effect on the average dose rate. So why, just to put this in some policy context, why should we care? Well, this is in the context of states that are rapidly changing their policy toward buprenorphine naloxone. 12 states and I think 10 of these have done this in the last 18 months, now have placed lifetime limits on treatment with buprenorphine. Those limits range from 6 months to 3 years, with most of them being in the 12-month range. And other states are increasing the stringency of their prior authorization requirements, so adding other requirements like additional drug testing, additional counseling requirements, and documentation requirements. So there's a lot of evidence that medication-assisted treatment is the most effective approach to treating opioid addiction by a long shot. And limiting access to medication-assisted treatment is likely to result in more relapses. We have some evidence that it will contribute to more deaths and certainly to higher costs from some of our other analyses. So we'd like to suggest that maybe a dose-related prior authorization requirement might accomplish some of the goals that Medicaid programs are trying to accomplish without some of these more adverse consequences. So So, thank you.